new games for special populations. The presentation begins after playing several games which were not recorded.
It's funny when you see people playing games, it's a very easy tendency to say, oh, they're having fun. What happens though is that you're actually dealing with things that are a lot more powerful than just fun. You're dealing with people's feelings. And we like to refer to new games as a concept of humanistic recreation, an idea that tends to bring people together. And when you do that, you bring out all kinds of things, some positive like trust and fun, some not quite so positive like confused and problem. It's not at all uncommon to have that kind of a response from playing, because at many times we may feel uncomfortable, we may feel inadequate, we may feel confused or unsure. That's okay if you're honest about that and say that that's there and needs to be dealt with. There's also a lot of awareness and uninhibited activity that people also find positive. In exploring new games, we like to refer to it as three main components. One is the idea of shared play. All of the activities we were doing and that we tend to do with new games involve an interaction between people. The interaction is in many different forms. At times it was competitive, at other times it was a very cooperative kind of interaction. The idea that the players are empowered, that the games can change. A lot of times when we do a session, people say, well, where are all these games written down? Where are the rules for these games? And sometimes they're honestly new games. They haven't been written down. A lot of times they're very old games. What's different about it is that people can change the rules and adapt them to whatever the situation be it a very crowded room where you need to play quieter games than you might want to play, or be it the thing that we've done that game before and we want to play it differently. We want to have a new way of experiencing that game and each other.
New games is also just for fun. So we may play in a competitive way, we may play to cooperate, but no matter in what way we're playing, we know that we're playing just for fun. And when we're playing just for fun, it allows us to do a lot of kinds of things to open ourselves up and to play hard and to really get involved in the game.
A lot of people involved in therapeutic recreation have many goals that they want to see come out of their experience with their clientele. That's fine, and there's reason to do that. What we'd like to also say is that there's a reason to have recreation with no goals on it, without any idea towards skill development, without any plan towards fitness, without even the goal that this is going to be a unifying experience for the group. You do it just for the fun of it. What you find is that in giving people that freedom, a lot of times they feel freer to explore and try and challenge themselves in terms of skill development, because there is no expectation. That interaction can happen on a more informal basis because there's no force that needs to happen. The idea of it being very just for fun is a very difficult concept to really embody, because we all try and accomplish a lot of things when we interact with people. But it's really the key to it. That's why we underlined it.
What you're not going to get from us today is a list of games to play with persons who are blind, or a list of games to play with moderately retarded teenagers. But rather, what we'd like to share with you is both our approach and some of the underlying principles to that approach. And also, I'd like to share some of the personal experiences I've had in new games sessions and programming that I've done with special populations.
Why don't you tell them just a little bit about where these experiences come from?
I work for the Iowa City Parks and Recreation Department in Iowa City, Iowa, and I coordinate a program called Special Populations Involvement. And I work with persons of many different ability levels, many different ages, and program both in sheltered activities and in integrated activities. And some of the things that I have done have been specifically new games play sessions, but I also feel that new games is very pervasive in all of the programming. So with that as an overview, maybe we can get on to what we call recreation experiences. I think any recreation programmer or leader is very concerned with providing a balanced activity, balanced programming for their participants. And in doing that, we're recognizing that a lot of different kinds of experiences are the prerequisite for leisure health. And we'd like to talk about some of the kinds of recreative experiences that we find play a very prominent role in new games.
I'd like to start at the bottom with playfulness. And it deals to a certain extent with the question of, like, what is appropriate behavior? I have an interesting perspective on this in that in working with New Games Foundation, I do a lot of workshops and seminars with adults dealing with play. And I tend to try and get them to play first and then talk about recreation, find a much more real approach towards it. I find that the desire to participate in inappropriate behavior is widespread among recreation professionals in this country. And I would say that that could be applied to the population as a whole. There is something very good for the psyche in being silly, in having a good time and giggling. And I think that a recreation experience that can provide that opportunity is really to be valued. Because there aren't that many things to laugh about if we start looking around the world. And if we can share some fun with each other, more power to us.
I'd like to talk about trust. And we're just going to take these in a random fashion.
Sure, we better check them off so we don't repeat ourselves.
When I start playing with people who have lived in institutions and have never been involved in any kind of a nuclear family, but when I start playing with people who have failed so many times that they absolutely have no confidence in themselves, or someone that has been in 5 or 6 different foster homes in the last 7 years, I play with a lot of people like that, and the reason those people have been in those situations is because they have some kind of a disability. The first thing I need to do when I play with those people is to establish a trusting relationship. That's not easy. There's no magical solution to doing that. You know, I can't pull that out of a book. It's something that has to happen between me as the leader and the person that I'm playing with. And as soon as we start developing that trust relationship, which very often is contingent on a lot of consistency and my being respectful of that person's rights as a human being, we start getting that going, we can really start getting something done in our play sessions. Doesn't matter if that play session is taking place in the recreation center or if it's going out to a concert in our community. Have to have that trusting relationship. So many interactions are based on that, just the idea that I can believe in what you say, and that if you ask me to do something, I'll try to do that. And also, a trusting relationship really opens somebody up to something else called challenge. And without a feeling of trust, it's very hard to be to put yourself in a situation where you're going to be challenged. And I know I've read a lot of times that, for instance, mentally retarded children do not react favorably in a situation where they're challenged. And so many of us just try to, you know, what do? We just, you know, give them the same kind of experience over and over, or we don't ever try to push them into new experiences. So I have this approach I called supportive pushiness. And the supportive part is the trust, and the pushiness is providing opportunities for challenge. And when people start challenging themselves, and then they experience success, it does incredible things for self-concept, and also has a lot of transfer into the person's use of their leisure time, because the more successes they have, And the more they, you know, investigate something new, they experience it, it works for them, they're going to go out and seek new opportunities. And it gets all back into that whole cycle that we call balanced recreation.
Along the same line of challenge is the question of competition and cooperation. One box that people like to put new games into is to say, oh, new games, that's cooperative recreation. I think that the mistake there is that it's only looking at one part of new games. That what we're really asking for, again, is a balance between the competitive and the cooperative. When we talk about a recreation program where we try and offer something for everybody, unless you have some competition in it, you're going to be lacking challenge for some people. Competition is a very useful tool in getting us to push ourselves. But the trap we frequently get into is that we make that the big thing. We make that more important than the process of playing. And so that the result of that challenge, of that competitive challenge, becomes more important than the challenge itself. The kind of a game that will work upon an elimination principle is a very common game structure. And if you look through games books, you'll find that a lot of games are based on that kind of principle, that through some interaction we have as players, we get eliminated, and whoever's the last one is the winner. A very simple game change we found immensely helpful is when there's a team situation like that, rather than one team eliminating members of the other team, they capture them. You have just as competitive a situation, but you wind up that those people who would normally be first eliminated from a game are captured onto a winning team and retained into the game with a success experience. In using competition without making winning the big thing, a lot of it has to do with your tone and your attitude as a leader, which is why it's helpful to present a play session that includes both competitive and cooperative activities, so that that feeling of trust and a mutual feeling of the players playing with each other rather than against each other is established within the group. And then the group can frequently feel really free to compete without having to keep score and without having to make the winning a big thing.
That leaves creativity and adventure.
Creativity?
Sure.
Okay. Creativity is an integral part of recreation and play. What happens in recreation is that, in fact, we have the word recreating a situation to experience something in a new way, to experience something that's brand new altogether. But we're recreating our world in our leisure time. And so, you know, from that standpoint, I just feel that creativity is, it's almost impossible to talk about recreation with me and without getting into creativity. And one way you can introduce it, like, into a program is to, like, focus on creative games. And you might think that that's sort of an exclusive category. But actually, when you start working with people and you find that all kinds of things are coming out all the time, and actually working with a group of people in a play session becomes very process-oriented. You're not worried about maybe what the final score is going to be. You're not concerned with who's going to win or lose. As much as you're concerned with what's happening to the people during that session, what kinds of new things are they finding out about themselves, and what kinds of new things are they finding out about other people and their environment?
An experience I'd like to share. A lot of times people, when I'm explaining a game, will say, what's the rule on this? Clarify this rule for me, I don't understand it. And it's the kind of thing where it really doesn't matter, but as players we need to agree on that. Very simple technique of turning that back to the players. Well, how do you want to play this? We can either play it that tag backs are allowed or tag backs aren't allowed. The game can be played either way. Merely returning that question to the players empowers them. It makes it become their game, so that the next time there's a feeling that, I got an idea, why don't we, you know, that there's a feeling that the group would listen to this or maybe consider it, there's a way of me becoming involved in that game. You set a stage for a feeling of adventure, of what are we going to do next? What can we explore? A way of creatively exploring what we don't know, which is a very important thing for us to be able to offer each other. That kind of supportive atmosphere where, you know, we won't let you walk off the cliff, but wouldn't it be nice to sort of explore around with our eyes closed?
Can I check it off?
Sure.
Oh, boy.
Your creativity, too.
Got it.
Oh, Brian.
Should we take some time for some questions?
We could model this and just turn it. Should we take some time for some questions as we go along or have the questions at the end of the session? Let's hear questions now. Yay! I have been asked to repeat the question into the tape recorder. The question is, why are these games new when she played a lot of them as a kid? Is that accurate? Okay. The reason they're new is because somebody might change a rule. I might change a rule when I explain it. A player might suggest that we try a new rule. In the process of that, it's interesting, like I find a lot of times people say, oh, I know that game. And then I explain it and they say, oh, have you ever tried playing it this way? And they'll describe a game that's practically totally different, but just happens to have the same name. That happens with a lot of folk games, which is what a lot of these are based on. All I can say is what makes them new is the attitude that we try and take as players and as leaders. That the play and the players are more important than the game. Any other questions now? Moving right along. A lot of times we find that the kinds of recreation experiences that are important, the people with disabilities have not had these experiences. As a result, there are certain things that are needed before we can actually create a play experience. We've listed three of them there.
People need skills. They need some experiences to base their, some play experiences to base this on. And they also need to feel involved. And along with involvement goes voluntary involvement. It's something that they have chosen to do. I'd like to start with experience. I have a foster daughter who's 18 and is considered moderately retarded and is hearing impaired. So now you know all of her disabilities. But it's sort of a strange way to go about describing someone. But I want to tell you, we just moved into a neighborhood where there are a lot of children around. And a little girl about 9 years old came over and said, can I play with Della? And I said, sure. This is the first time this has ever happened at our house. And Della, who had lived in an institution, certainly hadn't experienced this either. And Della just looked at me like, are you crazy? What do I do? You know, this girl came over to play. She had no idea what that meant. And it really started me thinking about all of the things that I learned as a child in my traditional play experiences. I learned a lot about spontaneity. I learned that when I was playing with kids that we could start another game anytime, or we could change the rules if we wanted to. Or that whatever we did was generally, you know, accepted and okay and would often become a part of the game. I also learned a lot about quitting and joining. I learned that when I wanted to join a game, all I had to do was go over to it, and I would have access to that game. That's something that Della has never experienced. I also learned that when it was time to go home for supper, no matter what was happening, you know, it was my responsibility to go home and get supper. So I learned that I have some power to make decisions about my play. And I started realizing that Della didn't know that. She was waiting for me, the recreation leader, to say, hey, this is the time that you go play, and you play this game, you do it for this long, and then the time's up, and then you come back and do this. But she still associates playing with going to a specific room with specific equipment, and the recreation leader is there. And somehow she's missed out on a lot of background information that one really needs to have in order to successfully play with other people. Another thing that you learn in traditional play experiences is why you need rules, and how rules are made, and how they function. so that for Della, rules have always been superimposed on her. She's always been told, this is the way you play the game, you do this, 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 and this. But she's never really been a part of generating those rules. She's never really realized why you need them. It's just always something coming down on her. And as soon as I started involving her in play sessions where she could change rules, she started really realizing the function and the need for them. And her attitude changed from one of trying to, seeing how far she could get without breaking the rules, to really understanding the rules and accepting responsibility for them, which made a whole lot of difference in the way she could play with other people. So all those experiences that we often assume that people have, and we base a lot of our recreation programming on those assumptions, I think we need to stop and we need to think about it. We need to say, hey, where can we start filling in those gaps? And with the new games approach, that's what you're doing. You're looking at every person and you're saying, taking the person where they're at and finding out what kinds of games can we play that will start building those experiences. And that brings us into skills. You can't play, there aren't a lot of games you can play without at least some skill development. And skill development follows sort of a developmental progression. So we start out, our group interaction processes start with, like playing one person with an object, and then you go into parallel play, and all the way up. All the way up ends with two teams playing with two teams. Each team has, they're cooperating to achieve a certain goal, but they're also antagonistic. Right, so a traditional competitive game. Now the problem I get into is that I'm working with maybe moderately retarded teenagers, and their parents say, we want our children to be involved in age-appropriate activities. And I agree, that's the way it should be. But when I take those kids into our physical activity and I think, let's see, that means they should be playing touch football and soccer and maybe volleyball, and I start playing those games with those people, I start, they just can't seem to pick it up. And it seems like we're constantly going in to stop the game, repeat a rule, we're having behavioral problems, kids are bored, other kids are overly anxious, and nobody's really playing hard. Everybody's constantly looking at the leader for another direction. And looking at that, I start realizing that those kids don't have the skills to play. They don't have the group interaction skills to play those kinds of games. And so what we need to do is take that game and make some new games to build up to that game. And so we start, if you need to start with playing with somebody one-on-one, that's where you start. And you start doing that. And say the game is football. You play some toss games of the football. You can go into playing a cooperative game using the football. And then you can start building up to that developmental phase. But the thing that I guess that I really rail against is the fact that when I see kids that I feel really have a lot of skills and they're put into a situation that they don't really have an understanding for, and then people look at them and say, look how retarded they are, And they're not retarded, it's the leadership. Because a creative leader could look at that situation and change it around and make it work for those kids so that they could be successful.
I think also in going through that kind of progression with somebody, again, when you're just tossing the basketball around and you're not even trying to say, this is the beginning of a game of basketball, but you're exploring the potential of that piece of equipment, that you not put the value orientation on that of, of course, this isn't as good as us playing really basketball, that the exploration and the learning that can go on and simply exploring a movement or piece of equipment or an interaction pattern is just as valuable as any kind of complex game. It really, it goes back to that thing, if you start with where the players are at and in the environment you have, if that's where my level of exploration and challenge is, let me explore that. Let me get the skills that other people might have gotten earlier just by simply playing around and exploring play and games.
I think we keep coming back to how important the values that the leader puts on the activity, how important that is to the outcome. So if You know, so rather than think, you know, we tend to think in games in terms of force and goal. So it's usually the harder and the faster, the better. And if you can start looking at other components, start looking at how can we bring up fantasy in this game? Or how, you know, the more fantasy, the better. Or the more ritual we involve, the better. Or how about this, rather than saying, how far can you throw the ball, saying, with how many parts of your body can you hit the ball?
How many different ways can you throw the ball?
Right. Mm-hmm. How far can you jump in this game? How about, you know, how far can you jump? How many short distances can you jump? How far can you jump still maintaining body control? That whole kind of thing in the leader's evaluation of the activity, to just start looking at alternatives in evaluation. I think it's very helpful.
Also, in terms of the kind of play that we're talking about, one thing that I find immensely important in terms of getting people to play, we get back to the question of how do you motivate somebody who maybe doesn't look on play or games as a very enjoyable experience, hasn't had that kind of repeated enjoyment from it. How do you get them playing? And one of the ways that I find personally most useful is to be playing myself. That you get to the whole question of trust of, you know, would you lead a game you wouldn't play in? I see people do it all the time. You know, what if you could have the kind of relationship with your clientele where they knew that you would never lead a game that you wouldn't play in yourself? Do you think that they would respond any differently to the activities that were being conducted there? And would they respond any differently to you as a leader? I think you'll find that they do quite a lot. That's the kind of, you know, like the main thing I would say to somebody about, well, what's a new game's leader? I would say they're probably a very friendly person. And that's, I mean, it might sound simplistic. Maybe it is. I mean, maybe it's something as simple as that being friendly and open as a leader is one of the fanciest tricks you can have for getting people involved with it. Because you start building, you know, in some of those basic things that are needed for play, like trust. So.
Involvement. I don't know how many times I've taken people in the community or led games when I just couldn't get their attention. I just couldn't get them involved. And what I do is I just go through a mental thing of, okay, what kinds of things, you know, where am I missing? And I think it's first to look at yourself as a leader, and then second, to start making excuses for your people because they have disabilities. It's real important. But very often when I have kids, you know, people in my activities who are bored, they may not be being challenged, or they may not understand what's going on. And once you start getting at that kind of stuff, you get a lot of motivation. Another thing that really cues into the involvement is whether or not the person is there because they want to be there, or if they're there because they have to be there. And many times I work with people who are there because they have to be there. There are still things you can do within your session to make that a voluntary type of situation. For instance, when you start empowering your players, they start realizing that they have control in that situation, even though that they've had to come. They're still going to have control in what happens to them once they get there. And it can make a lot of difference in their attitude and their level of involvement. And another thing I think really that happens when you start taking that kind of an attitude is that people can transfer that experience. So if they're in an institution, and they go to the recreation room, and they know that when they come to recreation that they, you know, that they have choice, that they have can make decisions that they can carry through on and receive support for, and then they're not going to be evaluated against their other playmates, then they start gaining a lot of confidence in themselves, and they learn how to explore, take that person and put them back into the community. They're going to have